Morning. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. I know some of you were here last evening. We have some other folks who were not, so forgive me if I replow a little of the old ground from last night, and then we'll stand for your questions and any updated items that you want to talk about. From our standpoint, the session started in January, 5 months ago, with a $2.2 billion positive balance in the budget. I proposed a budget that would allow spending to increase in the state budget by about 10% over 2 years. I thought that was enough. When GDP is about 3% economic growth, people's paychecks are between 2 and 4%. Inflation is below 3%. So I think having state government live within a 10% annual growth is reasonable and sustainable and responsible. And key priorities can be funded within that amount if you're willing to choose priorities and have a focus and a strategy, which is sometimes difficult in the legislative process. And our budget, of course, included no new taxes and a historic low level of fees. In the inaugural and the State of the State speech that I gave earlier this year, we focused on four key priorities for our administration. They were veterans and military support programs for the men and women who are serving in our military and veterans and their families. A second was fiscal discipline. A third was a better and brighter energy future for Minnesota and our country. Fourth was health care reform and improvements in our health care delivery system. I'll just touch very briefly on each of those and then stand for your questions. First, the legislative session yielded a very terrific bipartisan veterans and military support package. We got good help from key DFL leaders on this issue. We're grateful for that. Almost all of our initiatives were funded. And we didn't get everything that we wanted, but we got most of what we wanted in this category, and it'll be a nice advance and modernization of the programs that we have to support military members and their family. It includes things like more assistance counselors, guidance counselors for returning veterans as they come back to campus and try to weave their way through the financial aid system for college. It includes enhancements to the GI Bill. It includes a whole array of reintegration and support services for returning members of our military, and that's clearly one of the highlights of the session from my standpoint. Number two, fiscal discipline is something that was very important to us. We define that as living within our means, and for the reasons I just described, 10% is enough, and families don't get to go out and say, well, we only have a certain budget, but we're going to go bust it and spend it any way that we want. Government, state government, needs to learn to live within its means. And proposals to increase the state budget by 14 or 15% at 2 or 3 or 4 times the rate of inflation are not sustainable, they're not responsible, and it's disconnected from the reality of what's taking place in the larger economy and the growth rate of the larger economy in Minnesota and the country. Before the vetoes, we've passed out some sheets. You should have a press release. You should have a longer press release is, I think, one page. You should have a longer document that is a list of achievements, more lengthy, and then you should have a spreadsheet that shows some information about the budget looking like this. So I'll be referring to this page here. On the spreadsheet, if you look at the bottom line, if these are from the Department of Finance, and we have Commissioner Hansen here and Jim Showalter, Deputy Commissioner as well. These are preliminary, but they are from the Department of Finance, and they think that these will be close, very close to the final numbers. If these bills are all signed into law in their entirety without line item vetoes or vetoes, the rate of growth of the budget will be 10.1%. So it's lower than I suggested to you last night. I thought it might be 10.2 or 10.5. The numbers have been recalibrated now that we have the bills. It's 10.1%. We also have a very sound financial picture underneath that for the state. You know, we have dug ourselves out of a big hole, returned the state to fiscal stability, and the bond houses who rate our, you know, fiscal stability going forward are going to like these facts. In fiscal year 08-09, which is the 2-year budget cycle that will be starting this July, we have $200 million on the bottom line unspent as a cushion, plus for fiscal years 10 and 11, which is the 2-year budget cycle beyond that, we have $1.1 billion in structural balance. So those are very healthy numbers, and those were goals that we set to have those numbers at a robust level as we go forward to try to ensure the fiscal stability of the state. If that $200 million in 08-09 is not spent, it will roll forward into the next biennium, leaving $1.3 billion. So 1.1 in structural balance, 1.3 in budgetary balance. Those are very healthy numbers by any measure. Third, in energy and environment, I mentioned to you we had proposed for the last 2 years a standard, a renewable energy standard of 25% by the year 2025. That passed. It's historic. It's nation-leading. One of the leading environmental and conservation groups in Minnesota have called it the most aggressive renewable energy standard in the country. That's combined with most of our next-generation energy initiatives passing, including doubling the number of E85 pumps in Minnesota, decreasing our fossil fuel consumption by 15% by the year 2015, $50 million for the Clean Water Legacy Act. I know there's some concerns about whether more was needed, but the reality of it is, at least in the near term, the infrastructure to support that program has to ramp up. There has to be people hired. There has to be technical assistance brought to the forefront. And this was, we think, the maximum amount that the bureaucracy could actually absorb and deploy, and that will be ramped up over time. But we think that's a very nice start. In the area of education, funding and reform, there's $794 million additional for K-12 education, one of the larger increases in K-12 education in recent years. That overall money, if you look at that over the previous budget cycle, it's about a 5.8% increase. So you'll hear people putting different spins on this, you know, only 2-1 on the formula, or other people who want to promote the bill will look at it on an all-in, you know, Texas Hold'em basis, put it all in, it's $794 million. If you divide that by the number of pupils, you get different percentages depending on which slice of the picture you want to look at. I will remind folks that under my budget proposal on the general education formula, all schools per pupil would have received 2% in the first year and 2% in the second year for sure, but then they also had a chance to get an additional 2% each year based on performance measurements and results, so they could have received up to 4% each year. And that was, I think, a better outcome than the bill that you have before us, at least as to the general education formula. For those of you who don't follow the vagaries of all this stuff, which other formulas the money gets put into has a lot to do with how the money gets distributed. This thing, there's only about 20 people in the whole state who understand the school funding formula in totality. You know, the press and the public kind of latch onto the general education formula, and that's, you know, where most of the attention is. But in this particular bill, that's not even where the majority of the money is. Most of it's in other categories, which are more obscure and more difficult to explain. But depending, again, which category you put the money in, it affects the distribution of the money. So you'll see, for example, the Minneapolis Public Schools under this bill getting a nearly $1,600 per pupil increase. You'll see some other districts on the low end getting a $600 or $700 per pupil increase. That's about the range in the bill, with some exceptions, some outliers, $600 per pupil to about $1,600, and we can make the runs available to you if you're interested in it in more detail. It includes a continuation of QCOMP as a general education formula program. It includes our high school reforms in part, with particular focus on dual enrollment, you know, getting those college credits into the high school and paying for those and giving kids a chance to proceed with that. Regional math and science academies, and it's a good start on ACHIEVE, which will be for low and modest income students to try to take more rigorous, more relevant classes in high school and earn college credit, and actually then have scholarship money set aside for them if they achieve those goals. Higher education came in at about our budget proposal, which is, depending on whether it's Minsky or the U here, about 12 to 14% increase. That's a very robust amount of increase for the higher education system, and they adopted the House proposal to have tuition caps, so 3.5% for the U and 4% for Minsky, I think. So tuition will be contained at that level. And the overall funding levels, were quite robust to higher ed. They made out, in some ways, better than the K-12 system under this budget proposal. And then it also has at least the beginnings of a performance pay movement for higher ed. It's long overdue. You know, the tradition is give them the money and hope good things happen, but we'd like to at least start having accountability for the results and strategic objectives that we'd like them to accomplish with the money. And then lastly, health care. And this isn't a criticism, it's just an observation. Everybody goes around the state as politicians and talks about how education's the number one thing. But if you look at the number one thing in terms of the budget growth in this budget, as well as almost every other budget the last 15 years, whether they like to admit it or not, most of the money's going into social services. And that happens here at a very high level. This is a big bill with, if you include the general fund spending, plus the healthcare access fund spending, plus the TANF spending and other little side accounts, it is a very large increase, in my view, a misprioritization of the relative growth in the budget. Some growth would have been good in this area, but more of it should have been directed into education, in my opinion. That being said, there are good things in this health and human services budget. Healthcare access was expanded significantly for adults and for children. There's about 70,000 uninsured children in Minnesota. This bill will, through outreach and other activities, ramp up coverage for them, and it restores eligibility and increases eligibility in many other categories for adults as well. It includes our mental health reform. I think everybody knows we have a busted mental health care delivery system in Minnesota. It's fragmented. It's not coordinated. It's a relic of the past, and so this is a very important reform, and it includes funding to improve it along those lines. Also note, even though this is kind of insider stuff, that getting administrative and billing uniformity within the healthcare delivery system is very important. You got lots of insurance companies, hospitals, clinics, doctors all sending each other forms, having lots of people in the back room having to figure out compliance with different requirements by different third-party payers. Government programs, we're trying to get everybody onto one billing system, one code system. We think that'll improve the efficiency, and that's in the bill. And then the smoking ban will also have positive health effects. The health effects, detrimental health effects of secondhand smoke are well documented, and they are severe. And being able to have the smoking ban statewide in Minnesota, I think, will have a positive impact on health also. Job Z continues more or less in its current form with some modest definitional refinements. And then, of course, we pushed back and pushed out $5.5 billion worth of tax increases that were proposed by my friends on the other side of the aisle that did not survive the process, and I think that's good news as well. So that's the overview, as fast as I can do it, and I'd be happy to take your questions on those or other topics.
What about the tax bill?
What about it?
Well,
we I'll give you the answer is it's headed towards a veto, headed in that direction, I'll put it that way. And the reason for it is this. The bill contains many good and positive provisions, but it includes one thing that we told the DFL leadership would result in a veto if they didn't take it out, and that is putting government on autopilot, building back into the government forecast for spending that everything's going to go up automatically every year. And we told them during the negotiation sessions that that was a very large and substantial concern. Yesterday, when it looked like they were still going to keep it in the bill, late afternoon, we sent them an email that we kept a copy of to their leadership staff, indicating that if that remained in the bill, it would be vetoed. We had my staff call their staff and confirm that they received the email. I had somebody witness the call on our end so they couldn't deny it later. We later have firsthand accounts of the committee chairs, both Senator Bach and Ann Linchesky, having a copy of the email. We got phone calls over the dinner hour offering to get it out of the bill if we would trade them for something else, in this case the 21st Century Mineral Fund. We declined that offer. They had plenty of opportunity to amend the bill on the Senate floor as they did other amendments. It would have been an easy verbal amendment just to take that section out of the bill, and they went ahead anyhow. So they... No, it does not, Pat. It does not. And I don't think we'll need a special session. It would be unfortunate because there are many positive things in the tax bill that I'd like to go into law. In fact, many of them are our initiatives. But when I tell them in writing that if they put something in a bill, I'm going to veto it, and they choose to ignore me, that's not a good development. The reason it doesn't trigger a special session is this. The tax bill is essentially self-financing. It raises a little money. It spends a little money, the whole bill goes down. It has essentially no effect on the other bills or the overall financial picture I just outlined for you.
It takes down that LGA and property tax.
Remember now, you'll remember this and get you the clips. And DFL said there's almost no significant property tax relief in this bill. Please make sure you you remember that as they make that argument.
Right, but what's in there goes down.
It does not. What does not? What as to LGA county aid, township aid, if the whole bill gets vetoed, it reverts to current law. In other words, the only thing that would be affected is the increases in LGA or the increases in county aid. They still get this year's amount, you know, at flat level. Well, we had a different approach, Bill, and you know, first of all, the four things I outlined were our four key priorities, and we had a property tax proposal. But you can't have it both ways. They can't come out of the session and declare that the bill has next to no meaningful or significant property tax relief in it and then turn around 3 days later and say it's a crisis for property tax relief.
But on the other side,
I'm sorry. Well, if you look at the things I outlined in my State of the State and an inaugural address, our four things were the things I mentioned. We did have a proposal for property tax relief, but it was more modest because we had the money to spend without raising taxes. We chose to put it into education and some other things in our budget. The only real way to control property taxes is to put the cap on, like we've done in the past through levy limits, like many other states have done. It can even be inflation plus population growth or even go higher than that if you allow for a referendum. They have declined not to do that.
Governor, what about this line of credit that is supposed to be necessary for the coming convention?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of things if the bill gets vetoed that are going to be unfortunate. But, you know, that's why they made the choice, knowing the result, to put it in the bill.
But what's the outcome of that for the convention?
I don't know. The state would guarantee this. In every other city or where the convention has been, a local unit of government or regional government have got the letter of credit, not the state. So this was unusual to get it in the first place. I think it needs to be done and should be done, but we're going to have to work it out.
Is it part of the kind of contractual agreement that you're supposed to have by August 1st?
These are things that are all... That's possible. We will have to look into that.
You said if you veto, is there a chance that you won't veto this bill?
Well, we haven't even received the bill yet that I know of. So, you know, we're going to go through it line by line very carefully, look at the whole bill, make sure we understand it in its entirety. But for today, I'll tell you it is headed in the direction of a veto.
And, Governor, one more question on the RNC. Why should taxpayers be on the hook for a political convention?
Well, if you want the convention, that's one of the criteria for the convention. Philosophically, I would say they probably shouldn't be. But, you know, we have a state that's been awarded the bid. That's one of the conditions of getting it. And the city leaders, the public leaders who advocated for that thought it was worth it.
Any other people like
that? And by the way, Pat, just so you know, mechanically, as far as I know, the letter of credit hasn't been drawn on in other instances, at least in total. Never been drawn on. The other thing is, as money is raised for the convention by the host committee, the amount of letter credit declines. So between now and next year, if the fundraising is successful, you know, that amount would decline.
On the tax bill, Governor, one last question. Included tax subsidies for the Moral American towns and what's going to happen to those projects?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I told the Democrats that if that's in the bill, it's going to get vetoed. They made the choice, and now they reap what they sow. There's nothing in there that has to happen. There's lots of nice things to have happen, but there's nothing that must happen. There are many things I'd like to have done that are in that bill.
Any other veto targets at this moment?
Well, Pat, we will go through all the bills. I'm sure there'll be some line item vetoes. Our hope is that you know, we can move the rest of the bills out of here without a total veto on them, so we'll be focusing on the rest of the bills more in the line item category. Bill.
Conspicuously absent was transportation. It seems to have a stalemate with the legislature on that issue. What's going to happen?
Well, we need to make some improvement in transportation, and as I shared with you before, you know, the only significant progress in transportation has happened since I've been governor in 20 years. And notwithstanding all the lectures from the voices of the past, they didn't do anything. We put the most money into transportation in 2003 of any administration in modern history, and we've just had the largest run-up in transportation improvements in the state in any comparable period of time in 25 years. That money has now run out in the sense that the bonding package has run its course. And this doesn't get reported, but in the metro area, by the Department of Transportation's measurements, ever so slightly, traffic congestion last year actually declined. I'm sure it doesn't feel that way to people. So there's been some improvements. Now, does that put us where we need to be or need to go? No. Much more needs to be done. But the advocates overreached. I mean, you got county commissioners and the road contractors and the others. For 20 years, they've come in and asked for the whole enchilada, and they've ended up with nothing. It's the same. It's almost comical. I've watched this since the early 1990s, all through the Carlson years, all through the Ventura years. The road contractors gin everybody up, get the townie officers, everybody, and the workers, and they come out, and they say, we got to have our version of the gas tax or nothing. And we'll get nothing, and then the people will get mad, and the Republicans will get blamed, and then next year we'll get it for sure. And that's kind of their analysis of the situation. That's been going on 20 years, and certainly more intensively for the last 10 years. So my counsel to them early in the session was, rather than hanging out for the whole enchilada and getting nothing, why don't you try for something a little more scalable or modest that you could do this year and then add some progress each year or each biennium in the coming years. And they overreached. First they went for the 10 cent a gallon gas tax increase. You got gas at its highest rate in modern history, $3.21 a gallon this morning in Eagan. 79% of Minnesotans opposed the 10 cent a gallon gas tax increase. I was opposed to it. Half the legislature was opposed to it, or nearly half. So they end up with nothing again. So then they try the 7.5 cents, which gets incorrectly reported as 5 cents, underreported. It's 7.5 cents. It's 5 cents a gallon gas tax increase plus a 2.5 cent surcharge, plus the automatic metro sales tax, plus the optional rural sales tax, plus the license tab fees, plus the other thing they had in there. You saw the vote last night. It wasn't just the Republicans. They had a couple Democrats sustain the veto. The public doesn't support it. I don't support it. The Republicans in the House don't support it. They didn't have the votes to override. I think they knew that or should have known that. And so they take that up in the last half hour when they had other things they could have been doing. My advice to them is, I told this to the speaker the other day, if you would have come in more reasonable, maybe the results would have been different.
Governor, on the question of taxes and the gas tax and holding the line on no new taxes, was there any consideration on your part that this was a position that would bode well with national Republicans, conservatives? In other words, was this in any way a political decision?
No. I mean, this has been my position for a number of years. To suggest this somehow has to do with other things is just not fair or accurate. The other thing is, I said when I was running for re-election, I'm not going to sign the pledge because that becomes a distraction, and that's true. I know Larry's not here this morning, but that I still believe that Minnesota was taxed enough and we should live within our means. I was willing to do the FOC thing. I thought that was a reasonable change. It generated some additional revenues, and we also got some other business tax cuts along with that. But I think to suggest that a 10.1% increase is somehow miserly, only in Minnesota would we be having this debate, or very few other states. I mean, you got a $2.2 billion surplus, positive balance. We have one of the most highly taxed states in the nation already. And I put a 10% increase on the table, and now I got the Democrats saying, oh, no, we got to go to 15% to make this work. There are very few places where you'd even be having that debate when the economy's growing 3% GDP, paychecks are growing 2 to 4%, and inflation's 2.5%.
Governor, outdoor amendments, do you have any thoughts? Yesterday you said it would be a breakthrough. If that happened, obviously that fell apart.
I support putting that on the ballot. I used to be a co-author of it when I was in the legislature. And, having the time mismanaged so it had to come down to the last 15 minutes last night. They're here for 5 months, and they can't get bills of constitutional and historic magnitude heard because they run out of time, even though the bill's been sitting there for a significant amount of time. Same with re-ginning up a bonding bill if they wanted to do that. I mean, why did that have to wait till the last half hour? Well, it sets the benchmark or you know the at par mark for state budgeting, and what it says is if that change goes in, is we're going to have as a starting point in the discussion government going up by inflation on autopilot, and then beyond that, if you have a additional money, only then, if after everything's been inflated completely, will you have quote unquote extra money. I don't agree with that philosophically. I think people should be forced to make choices, set priorities, set strategy and focus. And that's part of why you have the results you have this session. You have people who overpromised everything to everybody. And instead of focusing on a few things that are most important, they tried to do a little for almost everybody. It lacks strategic focus. We should ask the DFL majority who ran as the champions of K-12 education and produced a bill that was mediocre.
Do you feel like in any way, if they're classifying winners and losers, do you feel like you were a winner this session?
I don't look at it that way. I just look at it as, you know, we got a divided government. People have to figure out a way to reconcile their differences and get a product to the people of Minnesota that serves our citizens well, serves the states well, and reflects some elements of the House, the Senate, and the governor. And I think this product does that.
Governor, we got time. We can only take two more questions.
Well, the 2003 plan was a catch-up plan beyond the normal level of funding, you know, so it turbocharged beyond their normal revenues. It allowed us to have that 4 or 5 year run up, 20-30% a year increases in road construction. If you look around the state, there's some very helpful and favorable projects. I'm sure they'll come back next year I think the advocates are not going to be satisfied until they get a gas tax increase. You know, it's not my position, but they're just going to keep coming and coming and coming. And, you know, I think there's some other things they should consider. Like, we just passed an MVEST amendment, by the way, to answer your question. It's as if that never happened. I mean, the people of Minnesota just voted on a constitutional amendment that will yield $300 million when it's fully phased in. That's compared, by the way, to a total construction budget at the state level, about $400 to $500 million a year. And to dismiss that as, you know, chump change is not very fair.
$60 million.
Yeah, but it ramps up over time to $300 million. But they'll be back, as they have been for, you know, the last 15 years. And no, I think we can work within this framework with the exception of the blow-up in the tax bill. The bills largely reflect kind of the discussions we had with the leadership, with some exceptions. They juiced up certain things that we didn't want to, I shouldn't say juice. They increased spending in certain categories. They changed some policy language. But through the line item veto, I think we can get these bills in a shape that they'll be signed with the possible exception of the tax bill. Oh, they received my message. They just chose to plow ahead anyhow. It's not that they didn't hear it.
Governor, in the campaign last year, you, Mike Cash, Peter Hutchinson, said it was essential for the state to get health care costs under control. You made some small steps here with the uniform billing and the electronic medical records.
And mental health reform.
Have we made significant progress? Is it breaking out under control?
No. They've chosen to focus on access expansion, Bill, and if you're going to do healthcare reform, you got to do access plus cost containment and quality improvements. And they have with all due respect to the folks involved, put disproportionate weight on expanding access and have largely ignored the reform agenda that needs to take place in cost containment and quality control. The good news is we did reach an understanding with Senator Berglund and Representative Huntley and other key players that we would stay at this over the interim. They've given me the ability to appoint a group that's going to study this and make recommendations on a bipartisan basis to the legislature. We have succeeded under my watch in slowing down the rate of increase in the HHS budget and premiums a little bit, but not nearly in the magnitude that we need to.
All right, thanks, guys. We got to run. Sorry.
Thanks.